with Tamar raping. You guys remember that whole situation. So Michelle even referenced it yesterday, kind of her testimony is part of her story. So significant story. Unfortunately, that's what's happening. So David's looking at some disorder in the kingdom. He is in the midst of having to deal with that. And we're going to see the ramifications of that. Lord willing, we're going to finish 2 Samuel today. We shall see. Okay. So with that in mind, let me pray. And then we'll dive into 2 Samuel 18 and hopefully tie a bow on the Samuels today. Let me pray. God, thanks for this morning. Thanks for the time to get your word to study. God, I know it's late in the year and we're all weary in our own ways with school, with work, with tests, with projects, with just life that continues to happen. God, I pray that you would give us the energy and the sustenance to finish strong, to keep our hand to the plow and finish the task that we committed to way back in August. So God, give us grace as we seek to do that, as we continue to learn from David and the like and these men and women that you have put in this book for us to study and learn from. God, would you elevate them in our mind's eye? Would you help us to learn lessons from them as we seek to become more like our hero, Jesus? God, it's to that end that we pray. In Christ's name, amen. All right. So as we finished off in 17, we see David leaving. You guys remember, through the Kidron Valley, up and over the Mount of Olives, into the wilderness. Absalom has taken reign. He has slept with David's concubines that are remaining there in the city of Jerusalem. David left kind of without issue and just said, hey, I don't want to be basically a stir or a cause of problem with Absalom. If God wants me to be back on the throne, God will give me the throne, but I'm not going to fight for it. And he left some advisors there. You guys remember Hushai was one of the guys that he left that counteracted the counsel of Ahithophel. So as David leaves town, Ahithophel says, man, we need to get on this quick. We need to attack David while he's weak and weary with the women and the children in the wilderness. Hushai comes in, who fakes support of Absalom and says, no. What we don't need to do is that. What we need to do is actually wait. David will attack you. If you try to go to battle with him now, you're going to die. And then he says to Absalom, hey, in fact, you need to go out in battle. You need to demonstrate as a young man your strength as the future king. You need to go fight the battle. And that's exactly what happens. So in 18 now, we're going to pick up on that story. Now, Absalom is going to go out to battle against David's forces. And David has now had time to rest and time to plan because of the mole of Hushai that he put in the kingdom. So 18:1, let's pick up there.
David mustered the men who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds.
Okay, and see, in verse 2, you'll see some names that you guys have seen before. Joab is in charge of one of those cohorts, one of the three camps. Abishai, okay, Joab's brother. Both of these guys are David's cousins. Is the other, and then my boy Ittai the Gittite. You remember him? Dude, I will pay anybody in this room $100 if you name your kid Ittai, since I couldn't do it. $100. Okay, but you have to call him Ittai. That can't be like some middle name, okay, like the third whatever name and whatever. It has to be first name Ittai, okay? $100, you heard it here, okay? Ittai was the guy that David said, hey, dude, listen, stay home. When I'm leaving, like, you're a foreigner, you're from, like, the coast, you're from Gath, that area. Don't go with me as I leave town. Ittai says, no, I'm staying. David has, this guy's a significant guy that he puts in charge of one of the three bands of armies that are basically going to fight. And he says, I'm going with you. And then David says at the end, I myself will surely go out with you. Idea going out into battle with his men. Now, David was 53 when Nathan rebukes him. Are you 53? How about that? When Nathan rebukes him at the end of the story with Bathsheba. So we're not sure how old he is. David's going to die at 70. And this is towards the latter end of his fighting career. So I'm guessing David's probably 55. I mean, he's an older guy. And what does he say regarding battle in verse 2? I'm going, okay? Now, why would David say that? What's changed in David? What happened in 2 Samuel 11 regarding the issue of battle?
He saw his mistake.
Okay, what mistake was that?
He stayed home.
Is he going to do that again? No. So he's a teachable guy. He says, I'm going to go to battle. Now, the guys around him have a bit of wisdom. They said, listen, you should not go out, verse 3, for indeed, if they flee, they will not care about us. Even if half of us die, they will not care about us. But you, David, are worth more than 10,000 of us. Therefore, it is better for you to be ready to help us from the city. So they said, hey, thanks. Appreciate your heart, Ittai, Joab, Abishai. say this to David, stay home. If you die, it's the end of Israel. If 10,000 of us die, we're collateral damage, but you need to stay here. David says in verse 4, hey, whatever seems best to you, I will do that. So he receives that advice. He recognizes he's not some 20-something anymore. He needs to stay home. This is a wise decision at this point in his career. So he stays home. Okay, Max, keep rolling in verse 5.
And the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom.
All right, what does that mean? What is David asking of Joab and the rest of the commanders?
Don't kill him.
Don't kill him, okay? So, hey, listen, he's my son. This coup needs to be put down. However, deal gently with him. And it even says, all the people heard the king when he had charged the commanders concerning Absalom. So this was public knowledge. He says it as they're leaving town, kind of from the city gates type of deal. Everyone understands what's going on, okay? Verse 6, keep rolling.
So the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the loss there was great on that day, 20,000 men.
All right, so David's forces win, puts down Absalom's forces. 20,000 of the men that were leading this rebellion with Absalom die. Okay, it was a significant battle. Verse 9, read this.
And Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak. And his head caught fast in the oak, and he was suspended between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him went on.
We have a children's Bible at home that we were reading the story. It's actually quite funny. So and there's a picture of Absalom hanging by his head from a tree, feet off the ground. So his mule goes underneath. The mule keeps going. His head gets caught in the thicket, and now he's kind of left literally just suspended like, you know, a doll in the air, right? You guys remember what the case was with Absalom, why this would have been probable? We get a description of Absalom earlier in the text. You guys remember what it talks about?
Long hair.
He's got long hair, right? And he would cut it every year, and it weighed a ton. So he's got this, like, I don't know, a ton of hair. So apparently that gets caught up in... probably not an oak tree, probably a terebinth tree or some other type of tree native to Israel, but is caught in the tree and he can't get out, which is hilarious. So here's the future king of Israel, right? And a tree defeats him. So a certain man saw it, tells Joab in verse 10, and Joab says, hey, why then in verse 11 did you not strike him there to the ground? You came upon Absalom hanging from a tree and you didn't kill him. Joab says, why not? And the guy, rightly so, in verse 12 says, hey, even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, protect me, protect for me the young man Absalom. Hey, David clearly said, don't touch him, okay? And he reminds Joab of this. So Joab's now heard this a second time, okay? Otherwise, verse 13, if I dealt treacherously with his life, there would have been nothing hidden from the king. This would have been bad for me. Now, verse 14, Joab is going to take matters into his own hand.
Joab said, I will not waste time like this with you. And he took 3 javelins in his hand and thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak.
Yikes. So he takes 3 spears in his hand and pierces Absalom through while he's literally hanging there completely defenseless in this moment. So... again, welcome to my love-hate relationship with Joab, okay? He gives some of the most phenomenal advice to David, and he's going to continue to do so in David's life, is loyal to him as a commander, and yet when Joab doesn't get what Joab wants, Joab does what Joab wants to do. He doesn't listen. He won't sit underneath authority. He won't do what David's asked him to do. So he does this, and then he basically... almost kills him, it sounds like. Verse 15, 10 of the young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom and killed him. So now 10 more men basically finish the job in verse 15 that Joab starts in verse 14. So Absalom, David's son now, is dead. This is 2 sons, by the way. Okay, Absalom killed Amnon. You guys remember that story. Now that was his firstborn son. Now his fourthborn son, Absalom, is killed by Joab. What was the... curse that Nathan the prophet reckoned to David when the thing with Bathsheba and Uriah finished up? Do you guys remember? You're going to have calamity in your family. The sword will not depart from your house. Are we seeing that fleshed out? This is the consequences of David's choices and his sin. This is what God said would happen. You've lost your firstborn. You've lost your fourthborn. Your house is jacked. Your daughter's been raped. This is a bad situation, and we're seeing the fallout of these choices. Okay, Joab blows the trumpet in verse 16. The people have won. They took Absalom and cast him into a deep pit in a forest and erected in verse 17 a very great heap of stones, and all of Israel fled, each to his own tent. So they throw basically Absalom in a cistern, in an empty pit, cover him with dirt, put a monument over there to remember basically his grave, and that's it, he's dead. Okay, they have a monument that's mentioned here in verse 18 that is still there to this day. Okay, mentioned there again at the end of verse 18. Okay. Now, Joab is going to decide to carry this news back to David and basically say, hey, we've won the day. We put down Absalom. Joab doesn't really care because he thinks this is the right thing to do. So he sends in verse 23, a guy by the name of Ahimaaz ran by the way. And basically, David sends two runners. Both go back with information to David. Verse 29, to not bore you with kind of the ins and outs of this story. They come back now to Jerusalem, where David is, not Jerusalem, but the city that David is now waiting in, with news for David. And the king says in verse 29, the first thing he asks when he sees these runners come, is it well with the young man Absalom? How's my son? Okay, which is a very natural response. Okay, the first guy that comes says, man, I'm not sure. There was a scuffle. I don't really know how it ended up. Okay, the second guy in verse 32, David asks the same question, and the Cushite answers David and says, let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be as that young man. Okay, what David heard in that statement was, anybody that puts a rebellion against you, David, may they end up like Absalom, i.e. dead. Put down. Rebellion's over. David understood what that meant. In verse 33, this is how he responds. Max, finish that up, if you will. 33.
And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son.
So David begins this kind of lamenting over what's happened. He wishes basically at this point in his life that he's would have died instead of Absalom, right? So it's he's now living a life of regret, a life of I wish I would have. Gosh, if I just would have invited him back in to see me after my sin and his sin and restored him, none of this would have come. So he's recognizing the folly of his decisions, and it's cratering him. So he literally is going into kind of hiding. He's going into mourning. And the guy that's going to bring him out of mourning is actually Joab. And it's brilliant advice. So 19:1, though Joab is a complete loose cannon at this point in the game, it's his advice that's going to get this guy to come out of this serious issue that he's got. And Joab's going to paint a picture as to why he can't do this. Okay, 19:1, let's keep going.
Joab was told, behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. So the victory of the day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people had heard it said that day, the king is grieved for his son.
All right, so everyone here is in the kingdom. He's grieved over his son, which is natural. But in verse 3, the people went by stealth into the city. So David's returned. He's back in Jerusalem. But the people are having to, like, come back in quietly into the city by stealth. Who are humiliated, the text kind of says. Verse 4, the king covered his face and cried out aloud, oh, my son Absalom. So all he's doing is wailing about Absalom. Now, what's the conundrum here? David got kicked out of town, right, by Absalom. All the people now, or a lot of the people, have joined forces with Absalom and supported him. They got put down, and now David comes back. What is their concern? He's going to kill us. You know, we all basically had to choose shirts or skins, and we chose the wrong team. And now David's back, and we're hosed. But what's David doing? He's sitting in his room crying. So what do we do? Like, is he for us? Is he against us? So they're complete kind of, they're sheepish. They don't know how to respond. They don't know what's coming. Is he going to come out of mourning and then start bringing the sword? Like, what's going on? So David's not leading. The people don't know what to do. So he's put his people in a quandary. And Joab in verse 5 recognizes this and says, David, you can't do this. Today, he says, you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines. by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. That's exactly what David's done, right? Have you honored the people that went to battle for you? No, they're kind of walking back into the city as well. Have you put down the coup or done anything to the people that were against you? No, you're loving those that hated you, and you're hating those that fought for you, like you're doing nothing. And in your passivity, that's what you're communicating, okay? That's what Joab is saying. By hating those who love you. End of verse 6. For you have shown today that the princes and servants are nothing to you, these men and women that have fought for you. For I know that this day, if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead, then you would be pleased. That's a pretty firm rebuke. If 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 of us had died in battle and Absalom would have lived and the result was the same that you won the day and got your throne back, you would be pleased. And David takes that because that's the truth. He realizes that's exactly what he's done. He's elevated the life of his son over the life of tens and thousands of people that have been loyal to him. And that's bad, okay? And David realizes that there is, though Joab is a loose cannon, there is truth in this. If David doesn't respond, we're about to see more calamity in his kingdom. Now, verse 7, this is Joab's advice.
Now, therefore, arise, go out, speak comfort to your servants, for I swear to you, I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, not one will stay with you. Not one will stay with you this night, and that will be the worse for you than the evil that has befallen you from your own youth until now.
What is he saying? Not one will stay with you through the night. You won't have a kingdom. They're going to go follow somebody else. And it's just a matter of who. Someone's going to step in and say, David's a chump. Hey, you all know who I am. Come follow me. And by the way, that's coming anyway. But it would have been worse. Okay. So the king arose. Verse 8, he takes that rebuke. He sits in the gate. And when they were told that people were saying, behold, the king is sitting in the gate, all the people came before the king. So now they feel the ability to come back in. Those that were exiled, those that haven't come back into the kingdom yet, that are struggling with, is David going to accept us? They now feel the freedom to come back in because at the end of verse 8, they had fled each to their own tent. Israel had gone basically away into hiding, if you will, back to their homes and weren't sure how David was going to respond. So now David's in the gate. He's out of mourning. He's leading again and is responding now to the people. Okay, and now they're going to have to deal with this tension. Like Israel had gone off with Absalom. Some of Judah stayed with David. Others in Judah, it looks like, even by trickery, ended up going with Absalom, and everyone is confused on how to respond now to this issue. So that's kind of the issue at hand. Now, verse 11, or verse 9, let's pick up there.
Now, and all the people were arguing throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, the king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled out of the land of Absalom. Absalom, who he anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now, therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing the king back?
So, hey, Absalom's dead, the battle's over. Why do you guys say nothing about why have you not responded to this? And the answer is obvious, because they don't know what to do. They don't know how to respond because they don't know what David's going to do. Then David says, now he says this to Israel. Now he says to Judah, speak to the elders of Judah. And he sends Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, like representatives on his behalf. Why are you the last to bring back the king to his house? Since the word over all of Israel has come to the king, even to his house. My brothers, verse 12, you are bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? So everyone's conflicted. Now, verse 13, rather, here's what David's going to do in order to basically demonstrate that he's serious about welcoming the people back. He wants them to come, and there's no repercussion for this. Okay, so who's Amasa? You guys remember? We saw him like a week ago.
Absalom's commander.
Okay, he's Joab's cousin. David and Joab are both David's nephews. Sorry, Joab and Amasa are both David's nephews. Okay, so they're cousins. What does David now do with Joab?
Fires him.
He fires him. Okay, he puts him on the bench and says, look, we're done. And in order to show you that the people that were loyal to Absalom, I'm going to take Absalom's commander and bring him in, and he's going to be now my commander. So he's trying to make the best political moves he can say to say, listen, all is forgiven. I even forgive this guy that fought against me. So if I can forgive him, I can forgive you. So it's a politically, it's a brilliant move. Now, Joab, how do you think he's going to respond to that?
No.
Oh, heck no, right? That is not going to go down under his watch. So, and again, we don't see the private conversation. We don't know if there was one. But he does something publicly, which would have been very humiliating to Joab, right? But we don't see any private rebuke. We don't see any conversation that these two have. And again, it's David's lack of ability to discipline people when they need to be disciplined that seems to get him in trouble, right? Seems to create more calamity. And guess what's going to happen here? More calamity, okay? So, thus, verse 14, he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man, and they sent word to the king saying, return you and all your servants. So the people of Judah say, okay, we get it. Israel gets it. They now return. Verse 15, the king then returned and came across as far as the Jordan, came to Gilgal in order to meet the king and to bring across the Jordan. So all these tribes are now reuniting. Okay, now David's going to roll across several groups of people in this process of coming home that are now some guilty, some innocent in this process. The first guy is in verse 16, Shammai. Shammai was the cursing mooner. You guys remember him? That's what I called him at least. He was the guy that as David went out of town, kind of followed him adjacent on the hillside and basically cursed at him and said, get out of town. You're worthless. You're a piece of trash. More or less in the Hebrew, okay? He realizes, man, more than anybody, I stated my case pretty strongly that I was pretty anti-David. And now David's back and Absalom's dead. What do I do? Okay, this guy should be the first on the list of guys that are going to get punished if David's heart is to punish. Okay, verse 18, Shammai the son of Gera fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. So he realizes, man, he's dead in the water. Verse 20, he says, I have sinned. Man, I've blown it. I'm an idiot, basically, is what he says. And then Abishai in verse 21, as this guy's confessing, has this to say.
But Abishai the son of Zechariah answered and said, shall not Shammai be put to death for this because he cursed the Lord's anointed?
Okay, that's a fair question. Okay, so Abishai says, always kill him. And Abishai likes to kill people if you haven't figured that out. Like, right now, let me kill him. And David says, what have I done to you, O sons of Zeruah, that you should this day be an adversary to me? Should any man be put to death in Israel today? That's the question that's that David's asking. Is that the right move? Should I kill this guy because he showed loyalty to Absalom and disregarded me? For do I not know that I am king over Israel today? Meaning God has restored my kingdom. Is it right for me to kill people as a result? Verse 23, he said to Shammai, you shall not die. Thus the king swore to him. So what is David doing in the midst of this? He's just being gracious, man. You're not going to die. He takes the high road. This guy was awful to David on his way out of town. Awful. And yet David says, you know what? This is not the day for death. God's restored the throne. We're not going to do that. Okay. 24 and following, you meet Mephibosheth. You guys remember the story. David's put down the coup. We've already read this. And Mephibosheth and Ziba and David kind of had this one last interaction, or at least Mephibosheth tells the story. The rest of the story was Ziba and what happened with the land and the servants and why he didn't follow David to begin with. David seems to believe him, but again, only gives part of the land back to Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth says, man, I don't care. Okay, and again, that's what makes me one of, what makes Mephibosheth one of my favorites. If David really believed Mephibosheth, by the way, what should David have done? All of it. And what should he have done to Ziba? If Ziba really is a lying piece of garbage, what should have happened? So what does David do? He does nothing. In fact, he gives him half of Saul's land. So, again, that's that struggle. Is David being gracious, or is David being passive and lazy? I don't know. And it's a hard thing. Now, David, it looks like he's being gracious here. In a chapter from here, he's going to bring the hammer. So he's not afraid to act. I think he's just reserving action. But I think, I wish I would have seen the story end up different with Mephibosheth. Okay? You get this old dude in verse 31, Barzillai. He's 80 years old. He meets David on the way back into town. And we find out he was supposed to go out of town with David, okay, when they were in the midst of this rebellion because he fully supports David. But David he says to David, hey, man, I'd love to go, but dude, I'm old. I can't even hear the singer sing anymore. Like, I'm 80. Like, really? You're going to have me travel with you into the wilderness? I'm basically going to be like dead weight. Do you really want to take me with you? Instead, he says, man, take my servant. In verse 135, you see it. Can I distinguish the good from the bad? Can your servant even taste what I eat or drink? I mean, this guy's saying, look, dude, I'm so old, you know. Cottage cheese and steak, they all taste the same to me. I can't hear. I'm old. Like, David, let me just stay here and die and not be a burden to you, okay? David says, you know what, that's fine. But on the way back into town, he's concerned that, you know, this would have been misinterpreted as a ploy maybe to now be loyal to Absalom. And David says, no, I get it. So they're good and they return. So David, you're seeing through this kind of the rest of this chapter, just being gracious to the people that are there and the people that have remained and maybe even that weren't loyal to him, he is now loyal to them regardless. Okay, so you're seeing some, on a good day, David's magnanimous, gracious personality. On a bad day, you're seeing hints of passivity, the unwillingness to deal with problems as they arise and to bring the hammer when that's required. So you guys can figure out kind of how to land on that, okay? In 40 and following now, we're seeing kind of the rest of the story in Israel and Judah and kind of their issues. We're seeing, again, this divide. So as they bring David back into the kingdom, let's pick up now in verse 40. It says that all the people of Judah and also half the people of Israel accompany the king as they bring them back in. And this is going to cause a division because Israel and Judah don't get to escort David back into the kingdom equally in terms of number and that sort of thing. Okay, 41, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why had our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household and all the David's men with him over the Jordan? Why didn't we get to participate as Israel in the celebration of returning you, David, back to the city of Jerusalem? Judah stole you away from us. And Judah's like, what the heck? No, we didn't. Like, all we did was bring him back. And Israel basically says, well, there's 10 of us, tribe-wise. There's two of you. There's more of us, so we're more loyal to David, and they're being fickle. What happened like a week ago when Absalom rebelled? What did all of Israel do? Hey, we're with Absalom. We love him. Oh, wait, now we love David. Oh, wait, who do we love? Who's not going to kill us? Oh, we love that. So they're just fickle, and you're seeing again this beginning of more tension and more division between Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And once we get to the end of Solomon's reign, we're going to see that split. But all the carryover from Joshua's days and leading into the land and the conquest, we're seeing these natural divisions with geography begin to split the people and the tension that's there between the north and the south. Okay, so in the midst of this barking back and forth, Israel against Judah, and why didn't I get my share, and why is my name not in the paper, why didn't we get to be on the front page of the Fresno Bee with David as he came back into town to be in this picture, this very shrewd guy, 20 verse 1, named Sheba, says, man, I got an idea. This is what he does. 20 verse 1.
Now there happened to be there a worthless man whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjaminite, and he blew the trumpet and said, we have no portion in David, and we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tent, so Israel.
All right, so who is this guy, and what does he say? Interpret that for me. Where's his lineage from? Benjamin. Why would that be important? Saul. Okay. And then he says, we have no portion in David. We have no inheritance with the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. What does that mean?
Let's go to war.
We have no inheritance with, we're not on David's side. So we're on Saul's side. We want to restore the kingdom to the Benjamites. All of Israel, all 10 northern tribes. We have nothing to do with David. Return home to your tents. We're not staying in Jerusalem. We're rebelling. So David's now got another issue on his hand. He's been passive. This guy has seen an opportunity to step in as a Benjamite and say, man, I like a piece of the kingdom. Thank you very much. That sounds like a great gig. I would love to be the king. And how do the people respond? All the men of Israel, verse 2, withdrew from following David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah remained steadfast to the king from the Jordan even to Jerusalem. So we've got now a second coup. Now, the first one was with Absalom. And David says, you know what? Hands off. That's my son. David realizes, I've got to handle this one differently. And Sheba's just some dude. He's not my son. So you're going to see David now step up and deal with this. Okay, verse 3. David brings back his kingdom to Jerusalem, puts the concubines basically in solitary confinement that Absalom had slept with. And then in verse 4, the king said to Amasa, call out the men of Judah with me, for me within 3 days and present them here. Meaning all the guys that just returned to battle, I need them back because we're going to battle in 3 days. So Amasa, my new Joab, go get them. We're going to fight. Okay. So verse 5, Amasa went to call out the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which had been appointed to him. So for whatever reason, David says, hey, you got 3 days, bring the fighting troops here. Amasa can't get it done. So maybe it's maybe he's not loyal to David. Maybe he's doesn't have the leadership savvy. Maybe the people don't listen to his voice because they're so used to listening to Joab. But in 3 days, David has no army. And he realizes, man, I have a coup on my hands. We have to put this down now. Okay? He delays. Verse 5, now David says to Abishai, his faithful, again, lieutenant, one of the three that has fought so loyally to David, hey, he says, go. Make sure that Shammai, in verse 6, does not find any of the fortified cities. Because, man, if he holds up in some place that's got food and water in a defensible location, we're done. So go after them. So he sends him with a bunch of men. In verse 7, Joab is one of the guys that is in Abishai's army. So he's been demoted, but he's still in the army. Okay, so he goes out now to fight Amasa. Okay, verse 8, they were there with a large stone. Sorry?
He goes to fight Amasa?
Yep. I'm sorry, not Amasa. They go to fight Sheba. Sorry. Amasa's still sitting home, twiddling his thumbs, trying to figure out why no one's going to listen to him when he calls the army. Sorry. Thank you, Max. Somebody's paying attention. Just not me. So Joab goes out. Okay. They find the armies. Okay. Verse 8, pick up there.
And they were at the great stone that is in Gibeon. Amasa came to meet them. Now Joab was wearing a soldier's garment, and over it was a belt with a sword and a sheath fastened on his thigh. And he went forward and it fell out.
All right, so Amasa finally shows up, you know, however many days later to do his job. He's like, oh, hey, glad you could come. So Joab goes to meet him. He's got his full military attire on, and he leans forward, and his sword falls out of his sheath, okay? So and he and Amasa are like face to face, okay? Joab says to Amasa, is it well with you, my brother, in verse 9? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. So he's picked up his sword now, okay? So this is typical Joab. Now he has an excuse to have a sword in his hand. He grabs him with his right hand to kiss him, and he has a sword in his left hand. What do you think's coming next? Verse 10, so when you read that.
Amasa did not observe the sword that was in Joab's hand, so Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow, and he died.
Wow. Just dirty. What did Amasa do to him? Nothing. Like, he just got fired. I mean, David's the guy that you have issue with, and the real guy you should have issue with is yourself, because you killed David's son. Like, now, you guys see the tension with this guy. He's a complete loose cannon. But he's probably the most loyal guy that there is to David, gives him great counsel when he needs to hear it. He's one of the few guys that will get in David's face and thump his chest and say, this is not okay. Like, get your stuff together. Go lead the people, right? So, I'm conflicted every year about Joab. I wish the story would end differently, but it doesn't, okay? It's weird that way. So, he kills him. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now, this is even worse. I mean, you're going to see just how cold Joab is, okay? So now Amasa's dead. So who are the people going to follow? Well, Joab obviously has an idea, okay? He says, whoever favors Joab, whoever is for David, let him follow Joab. So Joab says, oh, Amasa's dead. How about I be the new guy? Everybody cool with that? Sir, yes, sir, right? Verse 12, Cass, I won't do this to you. We need a guy to read that. Sorry, this is just gory.
Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the highway.
So literally, he guts this guy. He's dying while his entrails are poured out on the road. And he's like, okay, done with you. We got a battle to go fight. Everybody come this way. And like between him and the army is like flailing Amasa dying, right? And he doesn't care. So he calls everybody over. Keep reading.
And anyone who came by seeing him stopped. And when the man saw that all the people stopped, he carried Amasa out of the highway into the field and threw a garment over him.
So it's like a car wreck scene, right? And everybody's kind of like rubbernecking, like, oh my gosh, but no one will come after him. So they won't follow Joab because there's a dead guy or a dying guy in the middle of the road. They're like, this is awkward. So Joab basically just walks over, drags his dead body to the side of the road, and throws a blanket over it and basically says, okay, come. So doesn't bury him, doesn't show him any respect. He's just, and like, lets him continue dying, right? Just, he's cold, okay? As soon as he was removed, verse 14, from the highway, all the men passed by after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. So now they go to war, okay? So story over. So poor Amasa, that's his death. So guy's done nothing wrong, okay? Now, Sheba and his band of whomever are fleeing, and they're leaving north out of Israel. They go all the way up to this place in verse 15 named Abel, okay, which basically is like 4 miles west of Dan. So we're in the far north of Israel. They have chased him from Jerusalem all the way north, past the Sea of Galilee, 20 miles or so north of the Sea of Galilee, which is where Sheba now has basically holed up. And he goes into this fortified city, which was the whole purpose of them that's what they wanted to prevent, to get him in so that he couldn't fortify himself. And he now begins to attack this city, Joab and his men, in verse 15. All the people who were with Joab were wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall. So they basically said, listen, we'll tear this whole city down to get Sheba out of here. And in verse 16, look who comes in and saves the day. Cassie, I will let you read this.
Then a wise woman called in the city, listen, tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you.
So a woman shouts over the wall and says, hey, Joab, listen to me for a second. Okay, this is what she says. Meaning, hey, I have some wisdom. Okay, they used to come here for counsel. I was one of the counselors. So, Joab, pause and listen to me for a second. And this is what she says.
You seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. Why will you swallow up the heritage of the Lord?
Is that a fair question? You want one dude, and you're going to destroy this entire city, who, by the way, is loyal to Israel and loyal to you. We're a mother to Israel. We've been here since day one. So, Joab's like, Far be it from me that I should swallow up a city and destroy it. Like, that's not my intent. Cass, keep going. 21.
That is not true, but a man of the hill country of Ephraim, called Sheba, the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city.
Okay, so what's Joab's response?
Surrender Sheba.
I need one dude. Give him to me, and we'll take care of that. This is awesome. Love this woman. Keep reading.
And the woman said to Joab, behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall.
Like, you don't even really need all of him. You just need part of him. And I'll solve that problem for you. I will toss his head over the wall to you, and you can take that back to David, okay? We'll keep the 90%. You take the 10. That's the most important 10. And you can go home and show it to David. So what does she do? Keep reading.
Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab.
Gosh, I love this woman. Just go, hey, guys, we got a problem. That guy's head needs to be cut off, and then we need to huck it over the wall. Problem solved, right? She saves the city. It's brilliant. She blew the trumpet. They dispersed from the city, each to their own tent. Joab also returned to the kingdom of Jerusalem. She saves her entire city, cuts this dude's head off, throws it to Joab. Joab listens to this woman. It's brilliant. I can't wait to meet this gal in heaven. It'll be wonderful. Like, tell me that story again. So, wonderful gal. So it's funny, just the women that continue to show up in David's life. Do you guys notice a theme with all these gals from, not City of Carmel, David marries her, Abigail, thank you. You see Abigail, then you see the woman that Joab basically uses to kind of get David to the place where he admits his own faults and needs to repent. Now you see this other woman. I mean, the women are continually seen as wise, as smart, as shrewd, and godly. Okay, it's a cool picture that we're seeing throughout here. And Joab doesn't listen to anybody. He listens to her. So fantastic. Okay, Joab was over the whole army of Israel. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and these other group of people, Adoram. verse 24 was over the forced labor. Now, we haven't mentioned this before, but I think it's good to point it out here. And this is kind of just an oh, by the way, in the midst of the text. So basically, Joab returns home. Coup's done. Yay, we saved the day. And then you just got to get this report of who's who in the kingdom, okay? 24, Adoram, okay, we're going to see this guy under Solomon's reign as well, was over the forced labor. What does that mean? Who is the forced labor? Slaves from where? Israel. Some of them were foreigners. Some of them were not. We talked about, and Samuel says this, when all the people say, hey, we really, really want a king. And Samuel says, man, no, you don't. And they said, oh, no, no, no. All the other nations have a king. We want a king. You guys remember that story? And Samuel says, what is the king going to do? There was like, it said it like 8 times in the text. Take, 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 take. You guys remember that? One of the things that he said was the king is going to take your sons and daughters and put them underneath forced labor. Now, years from now, there's going to be a guy that's going to pull his hair out and lose his mind over this issue when Israelites force other Israelites to pay for land or whatever by giving themselves or their sons and daughters into forced labor because that's the only means that they have. The guy's name's Nehemiah. He's going to lose his mind. We'll see that in a couple weeks, okay? What has David done here? Is this a good thing? No. Okay, I hope I set that up well enough. No, this is not, okay? But you look at the things that are mentioned in David's life. Some of them are just an oh, by the way, and that's kind of how this is painted. We don't see a judgment, good or bad, against it. But David is doing a lot of things that are anti what God wanted of his king. Has David multiplied for himself wives? Yes. What does Deuteronomy 17 say about that? Don't do it. Okay, has he put his own people into forced labor? Yes, that's not a good thing. That is not God's heart. So as we paint David as a man after God's own heart, that doesn't mean that everything that's mentioned about David is good and right. This is not good. So David has some mars on his character. He still is a guy after God's own heart, but God's going to bring the heat here coming because of this issue and other ones. David's going to pay for some of these choices. Okay, so the kingdom is now basically restored back to David, but we're still seeing errors basically in his judgments, okay? 21 now, kind of an odd story. There's a famine in the land during the days of David after this occurred, probably towards the very end of David's life. Okay, some of the stuff is 21 and following are kind of like just snippets of stories, and we're not sure exactly how old David is, but probably towards the end of his life. And David basically goes to God and says, hey, what's going on? Why is there a famine in the land? Okay, and God says in verse 1, it is for Saul and his bloody house because he put the Gibeonites to death. Now, this story, Saul dealing with the Gibeonites, is not recorded in Scripture. We don't have it. Okay, who were the Gibeonites? Think conquest of the land, Joshua chapter 10, I think. You guys remember the group of people that realized we're getting spanked in battle, and if we don't fake like we're from a faraway town, we're going to get annihilated. So they come to Joshua and make a pact with him. They have old shoes, old wineskins, and they fake like they were from a faraway town, and they make this pact with Joshua. And Joshua says, okay, forgets to pray and ask God who they are, and then finds out days later that, oh, dude, you were like my next-door neighbors. You're not from a faraway town. We were supposed to expel you from the land, but now we can't because we made a covenant with you. And Joshua says he makes them hewers of wood and basically makes them serve in the temple for the rest of their lives. Well, Saul violates that covenant, and he kills Gibeonites. And we don't see the story, but that basically is what has occurred. And God says, because of this, David, there's a drought in the land. So we're going to have to deal with that, okay? So he says, okay, Gibeonites, you're right. What do you want? What do I do? How can I make this right? Verse 4, they say, hey, listen, we don't want money. Silver or gold is of no concern of us. However, what we would like, where do they say it? David says, I'll do whatever you ask. And they ask the king, verse 5, read that. 5 and 6.
They said to the king, the man who consumed us was a man to destroy us so that we should have no place in all the territory of Israel. Let 7 of his sons be given to us so that we may hang them before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord.
So they asked for what? 7 sons of Saul. What did David promise regarding Saul and his descendants? I'll take care of you. Okay, who specifically has he said, I will take care of you?
Mephibosheth.
So now he's in a jam. So is Mephibosheth lying? Does David believe his story from a couple chapters ago when he came back into town? Was he really loyal? He only gave him half the land. But now David has to hand over 7 of Saul's descendants, males, to be murdered. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. That's what they asked for. And if David wants this curse to be put down, and God says, this is why I'm doing it, this is what you do. So David's got a conundrum on his hands. Now, thankfully, verse 7.
But the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Saul's son Jonathan, because of the oath of the Lord that was between them, between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul.
All right, so David spares Mephibosheth. He gives 7 other sons away, one of whom, by the way, is named Mephibosheth, which makes the story even more odd. Like, how do you name kid that twice? I guess it's a family name. But in 9, he gives him the 7, and basically, they're all murdered. They're hung outside this Gibeonite city. Rizpah, verse 10, the daughter of 2 of the sons that are murdered, or the mother, sorry, of 2 of the sons that are murdered, goes there and basically goes and cares for the bodies and takes care of them. David hears about this woman's distress. They're not taken down from the wall. They're left there to hang for months. It is an atrocity, but they will not be taken off the wall. The Gibeonites are basically showing everybody that rights have been, or wrongs have been righted, if you will. But this mother goes and watches her sons, 2 of her sons, so these 7, just hang there. So David hears about it and goes down, and I mentioned the story before. I mentioned in Israel. You guys weren't there. Matt was. But verse 11, Dave hears about this. David hears about this. In verse 12, watch what he does.
David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan from the men of Jabesh-Gilead and had stolen them from the public square of Bethlehem, where the Philistines had hanged them, on the day the Philistines killed Saul on Gilboa.
Okay, so David takes now the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan from the men of Jabesh-Gilead. Do you guys remember that story when they hung Saul and his son outside the camp? They took their bones. David goes in and takes their bones back in order to honor them, as well as these 7 sons that have all been hanging there, and brings them all back and gives them a proper burial in Saul's tribal lands in Benjamin. So honors them, honors this mother. Verse 14, look at the last sentence of verse 14. God was moved by prayer for the land. So the idea is David does what's right, as horrible as this is, to pay for the sins of Saul. They have done, according to God, what is right in his eyes. They pray again for the land, and God now brings the drought to an end. So it's a cool story about how God, at least at the end of this, is moved by prayer and what he does for the land of Israel, but is also not going to let Saul lead however he wants to lead and go against the covenant that Joshua had made literally 100-plus years before him. He makes him deal with that, okay? Now, 15 and following, we get our last little ditty on the Philistines and kind of the continued skirmishes that happen between David and his men and the Philistines. And again, this is in the last probably, 5 years of David's life. So he's probably 60, 65 maybe. He's going to die at 70. So this is kind of what's happening, okay? So pick up here in 15.
There was war again between the Philistines and Israel, and David went down together with his servants, and they fought against the Philistines. And David grew weary, and
Ishbenob, or I guess
one of the descendants of the giants, whose spear weighed 300 shekels of bronze, and who was armed with a new sword, thought to kill David.
All right, so you get this giant. This is like Goliath-esque, okay? Big dude. He's got a new sword. He's Goliath and then some. David's on the battlefield, which again, good decision, bad decision, I don't know, but he's there and he's fighting, and he's about to get killed by this giant. I mean, we're in a bad way. Okay, look who shows up in verse 17.
But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and attacked the Philistine and killed him.
So who comes in and saves David's bacon? Abishai, once again. And he says to the men of David, swore to him, saying, you shall not go out again with us into battle, that you may not extinguish the lamp of Israel. David, thank you. You learned a hard lesson from Bathsheba in that story. Thank you for your heart. You're an old fart. Go home, okay? We'll fight the battles for you. If you die, the kingdom dies. This is not okay. So I like that David's out fighting, and it's his men who say, we got it. Our job is to take care of Israel and to take care of you. But dude, mandatory retirement, you're done. Go eat bonbons, watch Oprah. We'll handle it from here, okay? So I appreciate the heart behind it that David's not the one that's sitting at home and commanding all the people, right? Peggy, that's what you do in retirement, right?
That's
you eat bonbons? Okay, I thought. I'm not quite there yet, so. Yeah? I'm eating bonbons, sitting in my big fat chair. High on the hog. Okay, more of the Philistines, verse 18.
After this, there was again war with the Philistines of God. Then Sibbecai, the Heshethite, struck down Saph, who was one of the descendants of the giants.
All right, so more interactions, more giants we're still seeing. These are the descendants of Goliath. And then we get this odd story in 19 and following. Read this. The next verse.
And there was again war with the Philistines at God.
God, by the way, is Gezer. So Gezer, Bet-Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish, one of the gateway cities. Okay, so one in the Shephelah, one of the battleground cities. Okay.
And Elhanan, the son of Jar, or Jim, the Bethlehemite, struck down Goliath the Gittite. The shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam.
Does that sound familiar?
Wait, who killed him?
Exactly. So you got Goliath that's killed by a Bethlehemite named Jar-A-Origim, or whatever you say that guy's name, right? So I'm sorry, wait a second. Who killed Goliath? I thought we read about that in 1 Sam 17. David. David killed Goliath, right? And now here, it's got a note that some other dude, who's also from David's family, he's at least a Bethlehemite, kills Goliath. So a couple options. Will, before I go, yeah.
My Bible has in italics the brother of.
So that's one option. This is the brother of Goliath, who's also named maybe Goliath, or just, you know, what was that TV show where the three Larrys? This is my brother Larry. You know, they're all named Larry. They're all brothers. So maybe there's, well, that's look, Mo, Curly, and yeah. This was after that, like an 80s sitcom. Anyway, but they're all three brothers. They're all named Larry. Okay, so maybe there's just not a big selection of names in their family. I don't know. This could be that it's the brother of Goliath, which I think is actually what's happening here, and it's just a similar story. Some have basically said, no, the Bible's wrong. They've taken this story, which actually happened, and presented it as if David killed Goliath way back in 1 Samuel 17, where David would have been 13. David's now 65 or older to make David the hero. Okay?
Well, isn't it like in Chronicles or Kings where it talks about David also going and finding the brothers of Goliath and killing like the five brothers?
He takes five stones with him, which is assumed. This same story is recorded in Chronicles in the same time period. So it seems like, no, these stories are 60 years apart from one another. They just happen to be similar, and the Chronicles story actually says, what does it say? Brother of Goliath, I think, is the at least the take. I can't remember if that's in Chronicles or not. Yeah, Haley.
My Bible has a note that it's possible that Elhanan is another name for David, like Solomon had another name.
Yep.
Which is another option.
Yep. I got a note on the exact same thing. So, are you? What kind of Bible do you have, by the way?
John MacArthur Study Bible.
There you go, Johnny Mac. So. Whatever, it's just an odd deal. It seems very similar. So, and again, that doesn't discredit the story, but there is just some questions as to why that's there. Okay, so at the end of the day, David's going home. He's going to retire. Israel basically is kind of put down the Philistines for a while. And as we get into Solomon's life, we're not going to see Israel battling the Philistines. They're going to be dealing with Egypt. They're going to be dealing with other nations, but it's not primarily the Philistines. So this is kind of the end of their reign against David and the kingdoms of Israel, if you will. Okay, that's the idea. Chapter 22, just put a note above chapter 22, Psalm 18. Okay, this is Psalm 18. So we won't read it, but for reference, again, it's a Psalm of David. And again, it's one of the cool things that you get to see. Saul didn't write Psalms. Solomon doesn't write Psalms. David writes Psalms. David is king of Israel. It's just a cool combo. You wouldn't necessarily think of a warrior king being that and also being a guy that's got a soft, tender shepherd's heart in his spare time, is at home with the harp, writing songs. And this is his quiet time, right? I mean, you're reading David's quiet times, which is phenomenal to think about, that thousands of years later, we spend our time connecting with God reading this guy's journal. It's really cool. So you see the uniqueness of David, that you don't see those personality traits put together often, of a guy that could go out and fight and a guy that could come home from battle and worship in a deep, significant way. And it's amazing. So I encourage you guys to read it. We're not going to go through all of it, but Psalm 18 is the exact same picture as what's happening here in chapter 22. Okay, so now chapter 23, this is David's swan song, and we'll see it move all the way into 1 Kings. But David is moving towards death. He knows it. Everyone around him knows it. It's at the end of his life. So we're in year 70-ish. And David's going to begin to record some things about his life. And this is a cool chapter, okay? This is a dude's chapter, if you will, okay? 23:1. Let's pick up there.
Now these are the last words of David. The oracle of David, the son of Jesse, the oracle of the man who was raised on high.
All right, now, just notice what's mentioned about him. I love that this is how David chooses to kind of how to remember himself, if you will.
The anointed of the God of Jacob, the sweet psalmist of Israel.
The sweet psalmist of Israel. Isn't that cool? Not the warrior king, not, you know, whatever. It's he's mentioning his depth of relationship with God. Okay, keep going.
The Spirit of the Lord speaks by me. His word is on my tongue.
Can you imagine that kind of power in a way, but like you would speak the words of God, that God would put his intentions on your mouth and speak, this is my desire for the nation. I met with God and this is what God has told me to do. Israel, right? David is recognizing he's stepping back at his life and he's looking at his life in whole and he's pointing out the things that have been most significant to him. I write psalms about God. I'm the sweet psalmist of Israel. I speak the words of God. Okay, keep going.
The God of Israel has spoken. The Rock of Israel has said to me, when one rules justly over men, ruling in the fear of God, he dawns on them like the morning light, like the sun shining forth on a cloudless morning, like rain that makes grass to sprout from the earth. For does not my house stand so with God?
Okay, stop right there. So what's David reminiscing on in verse 4? What is he like? Guy's awake. It's like the sunrise on a day, in a cloudless day. Michelle and I were rolling home from residency yesterday, watching the sunrise over the Sierras. I'm like, good Lord. I literally said, that doesn't suck. Like, are you kidding me? Like, we get that here? That's what David's comparing his life to. I'm like the sunrise on a cloud. Like, God has allowed me to be this for Israel. That way they look at that and go, yes! Like, that's the king that we had hoped for and wanted, okay? And we're going to get 41 other kings that are all not like that, okay? But David is the one that is. And there's a few others that I guess that are good. Now, again, think about this in context. David is reminiscing on the things that are most important to him, most significant during his reign. Verse 5. Truly is not my house so with God, for he has made an everlasting covenant with me, ordered in all things and secured for all my salvation and all my desire. Will he not indeed make it grow? What is David saying? What is this referring to? Has he not made an everlasting covenant with me? You're going to want to know this for the exam. The Davidic covenant. What is David reflecting on at the end of his life? It's not just about a house. It's not just about a temple. What is it about? God has given me a line, and from me is going to come who? Messiah. I mean, good Lord, that's amazing, right? David is, I get to be in that line? Like, God has made a house for me? That's insane. And he realizes that Solomon, immediately, but yet future, it's the Messiah. What a privilege, you know, to be in that line. So David is reflecting on 2 Samuel 7, the Davidic covenant, and the significance of that. Okay, but verse 6, worthless men, every one of them will be thrust away like thorns because they cannot be taken at hand. God has blessed me for whatever reason. I'm not going to be burnt up like the shaft and the scraps of the harvest. I'm the wheat. Like, I get... a privileged position because God has just granted me that. So that's what David's talking about. So the 23 is kind of the end of kind of this psalm that he starts now in chapter 22. But you see, again, at the end of David's life, what's important to him, okay? Who he was, his character, what he got to do for Israel, what God did through him in this covenant now that David has enacted, that God has enacted with David, okay? Now, 23, 8, and following, you see the title at the top. This is the story of David's mighty men, okay? There are 37 men mentioned in this chapter. These are the guys that have been the most loyal to David throughout his life, going way back to the cave of Adullam in 1 Samuel 22 when David was in hiding from Saul. These 40-plus years, they have taken care of this guy, been with him, and David is now going to basically immortalize them in Scripture and say, these are the guys that are awesome. By the way, there's one name that is notoriously absent from this list. Who is it?
Uriah.
Not Uriah. He's in here. Joab. Abishai is mentioned, okay? And Ashahel is mentioned, Joab's brothers. Joab is mentioned in the fact that it says Ashahel, Joab's brother. Abishai, Joab's brother. Joab is nowhere in here, okay? So you can see at this point, their relationship has soured. It is bad. In fact, David's going to tell Solomon when he hits the throne, there are three dudes I need you to deal with. Shimei, the cursor, who I said, I won't punish him, but Solomon, you do what you see is right. Some other dude who I forget right now. And Joab says, you go deal with Joab. And Solomon is going to murder Joab. Murder meaning he's going to enact justice on Joab for his actions because of what he's done. David was too whatever to deal with it. So he leaves Solomon with kind of a list of things like this. This is the U-Haul leftovers from my kingdom. This is the closet, if you will, that I failed to deal with. David, or Solomon, if you're going to rule rightly, you need to deal with these issues, okay? So, but in 8 and following, these are his dudes, okay? And they are bad. Verse 8, somebody pick up there. We'll read about this first guy.
These are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Josheb, Bathshebeth, a Tachemonite.
That's why I'm not reading it.
He was chief of the three. He wielded his spear against 800 whom he killed at one time.
800. That is not a misprint. And I don't even know how to say the guy's name, okay? One of the three means there are three in the midst of the 30, and the word for this group of people is 30, but it's actually 37. The Hebrew literally means 30. There are three basically commanders. Abishai and Ashahel are not part of that, though they're exalted, but there's three dudes that are uber bad, okay? This is the first one. He kills 800 men by himself at one time. That's awesome. Okay, that's all this guy gets in Scripture. Okay, verse 9, keep going.
And next to him among the three mighty men was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, son of Ahohai.
And if you got a name like Dodo, man, you've got to do something to distinguish yourself. So he does.
He was with David when they defied the Philistines who were gathered there for battle, and the men of Israel withdrew. He rose and struck down the Philistines until his hand was weary, and his hand clung to the sword.
Like, he's so exhausted from battle, his hand is weary, but he continues to fight, okay? And the Lord brought about a great victory that day, and the people returned only after to strip the slain. Like, this guy did everything, and the people only came back to pick up the stuff that was left from the dead people that he had killed. So this guy's awesome, okay? 11, keep going, Max.
And next to him was Shammah, the son of Agi, the Hararite. The Philistines gathered together at Lehi, where there was a plot of ground full of lentils, and the men fled from the Philistines.
So everybody flees. This guy, all his buddies flee. He's in a field of lentils, like, small stage, not significant, but...
But he took his stand in the midst of the plot and defended it and struck down the Philistines, and the Lord worked a great victory.
So this guy's, it's an insignificant deal, and that man, his name didn't hit the paper, but boy, he took a stand, fought for Israel. The battle literally turned on him fighting, and these are the type of men that David has surrounded himself with, okay? So he takes a stand, and Israel wins the day. Then three of the 30 chief men went down and came to David in verse 13. In the midst of the harvest, when David was at the cave of Adullam, so this goes way back to 1 Samuel chapter 22, three of David's 30 come to him. And David says, man, I'm really thirsty. Verse 15, David had a craving and said, oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate. So David says, we're in Adullam, okay, in the Shephelah. I need someone to go to Bethlehem. Like, boy, I wish I had water from my hometown. Bethlehem, that's 20 miles to the east, through the enemy to get there. And these guys say, done. Verse 16.
Then the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines and drew water out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate and carried and brought it to David.
Wow. So these guys make a trek, get a glass of water to Bethlehem, 20 there, 20 back-ish, bring it all the way back to David, and then what does David do?
But he would not drink of it. He poured it out to the Lord and said,
now, hold on. How would you interpret that if you just went on like a nighttime jaunt for 40 miles and David now takes a glass of water that you brought him and he pours it out? Potentially offensive, right? But they don't see it that way. You guys remember in Numbers, there's the drink offering? I think that's what David's doing. He's saying, this is so valuable. What these guys did was so significant. I'm going to offer it to the Lord. Like, I'm not even going to drink it. So he's immortalizing them, if you will, and saying, man, that would be beneath you guys and what you have done for me to drink of that. Okay? He said, far be it from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Verse 17, shall I drink the blood of the men who went in their jeopardy of their lives? Therefore, he would not drink of it. These things the three of the mighty men did. So he pours it out and does this amazing thing. And they interpret it that way, obviously. 18, Abishai, the brother of Joab, was there. He swung his spear in 18 against 300 and killed them. And he had a name as well as the three. So he's not in the elite three, if you will, but he's significant. We've read his story this whole time. He takes down 300 dudes in a day. Okay, that's impressive. And apparently the guys, you got to kill like 800 in a day to make it into David's like elite, you know, SEAL Team 6 ranks of the three. But this guy gets it done. Okay. Verse 19, he became most honored of the 30. Therefore, he became their commander. However, he did not attain to the three. Now, 20, this is one of my favorite dudes in Scripture.
And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was a valiant man of Kabzeel, a doer of great deeds. He struck down two aerials of Moab. He also went down and struck down a lion in a pit on a day when snow had fallen.
So this guy, man, beast, it doesn't matter. He gets it done. He kills two sons of Ariel of Moab, so two significant people in Moab. And then it says he killed a lion in the middle of a pit on a snowy day. Right? You got a hard task, a hard place, and a hard time. I mean, this guy, he's in a cistern, more than likely, there's a pit in Israel, and it's him versus a lion on a snowy day. Like, there's no way out. This is cage match, right? You can't leave. You're going to fight to the death. One of you is going to leave breathing, and the other is going to be bloody. So, and he wins the day. That's Benaiah. So, like that dude as well, okay? 21, this is what I love about this guy. You guys remember the movie Tombstone? Have you guys seen that? Golly. Go watch it. Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday, go watch Tombstone if you've not seen it. This is where they got the scene from, right here, okay? One of the most famous scenes in the movie came from this verse.
And he struck down an Egyptian, a handsome man.
Mine says, by the way, impressive. So I think that's kind of the context. Like, this dude's bad, okay? The Egyptian that he's fighting against.
The Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but Benaiah went down to him with a staff and snatched the spear.
Okay, stop for a second. This is what you call bringing a knife to a gunfight. Like, oh, I think I'm a little bit outmatched here. So this guy's got a spear. Benaiah has a club. He's like, oh, dang it. I didn't get the memo that the rules of engagement had changed. I'm going to lose this battle. So this is what he does.
Went down to him with a staff and snatched the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear.
Yes! That's awesome! He grabs the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and rails him through with his own spear. If you haven't seen the scene in Tombstone, this guy's popping off to Doc Holliday, who's one of the characters in the movie, and he literally grabs the guy's gun out of his holster, smacks him with the butt of his own gun, And then looks at him. It's this guy standing there like dumbfounded, bleeding from the mouth. And he says, are you going to do something or just stand there and bleed? And you're like, oh, no. He just totally clowns this guy. Go watch the movie. It's amazing. So if you like Westerns, it's bad. But this is Benaiah. Like, far before there was ever a Doc Holliday, there was a Benaiah. Grabs his spear out of this guy's hand and pierces him through and kills the guy. So, sorry, ladies. It's just a good day to be a guy, okay? So, these are David's guys. So in a day and age when this is what was called for, David has loyal, steadfast men that are willing to fight for Israel. They're willing to fight for him. And David takes the time to remember them. This isn't about David. He's immortalizing these guys, which is awesome, okay? Verse 22, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, made a name for himself as well, okay? Verse 24, you see Asahel mentioned, okay, again, the brother of Joab. But Joab, again, never mentioned in the text. In 25 and following, the rest of the guys that are mentioned. In verse 39, the last name. Somebody read that. Uriah the Hittite. Okay, so again, you think about how well David knew the stories of these men, their encounters in their lives. Do you think the same would be true of Uriah? Yeah, so he knows this guy. This isn't a foreigner. This isn't somebody that he's not familiar with. He was part of his elite fighting forces. David's got hundreds of thousands of people that can go to war. 37 guys are mentioned here, and Uriah is one of them. So just for context, significant. So, okay. 24, this is kind of an odd chapter, okay? Verse 1, 24, read that.
And the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel, and moved David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah.
Okay, so this is an odd text, okay? The anger of the Lord burned against Israel. So God's mad for some reason. And what's the cause of it? The end of verse 1. Yeah, and it incited David against them to say, go number Israel against Judah. So what is David apparently, or sorry, go number Israel and Judah. What does David do here? He takes a census. You guys have heard the story before. He goes and counts his people. In context, in Chronicles, this fits, it looks like, right after David regains the throne, after the rebellion of Absalom is put down, okay? So he's trying to figure out, who's on my team, right? So he goes and counts everybody. This text makes it look like it was God who incited David to do that and then gets mad at David for doing that, okay? Chronicles says it was Satan, okay? So David, his heart was tempted to go count the people. Why would David be tempted to go count the people after he's restored the kingdom to himself?
Find some security and numbers.
Absolutely. How many people do I have to fight? What do I have? Why would God be frustrated at that? Trust in me. Don't worry about how many people you got to fight. I'll take care of you. Did I just restore to you the kingdom? Yes. Did I take care of you? Did you walk out of town and walk back in? Don't worry about it. Well, God's mad. And guess who, by the way, in verse 2 says, this is a really stupid idea, David. You shouldn't do it. Joab. Gosh. I mean, are you conflicted with him? I want to love the guy, and I just can't. But Joab is the only guy that says, David, this is stupid. And not, listen to how he phrases it. This is brilliant.
So the king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, now go out to the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and count the people that I may know the number of the people. And Joab said to the king.
Okay, so he's commanded to go do this. Joab's been put to task, and this is his response.
Now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times more than there are, and may the eyes of the Lord the king see it. But why does the Lord the king desire this thing?
So what is Joab saying?
Why do you want?
Why do you want this? And by the way, I wish that God would bless you even further. So it has nothing to do with God. I want David, you to be blessed by God. But the way that you're going about this is not going to accomplish that. In fact, this is evil, okay? This is not what you want to do. So he offers a check, but verse 4, the king's word prevailed against Joab and against the commanders of the army. So David says, shut up, go number my people. And he does. And Joab comes back with a report, so he's faithful. Verse 8, it took 9 months and 20 days. In verse 9, we find out there are 800,000 men in Israel and 500,000 men in Judah that can draw the sword. So we have a fighting force of 1.3 million people, okay? So David gets the number that he wants and then realizes months later, crud. Joab is right. Verse 10, David's heart troubled him after he numbered the people. David says to God, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. And he confesses, and he says at the end of verse 10, I have acted very foolishly. So was Joab right? Yeah. Was David unwilling to listen? Yeah, and you see why. Like, Joab had just got through killing Amasa, right, and Absalom. So this is a Jack situation, or at this point, at least Absalom. So there's tension in the relationship. His advice is great, but David won't hear it. And basically, God sends now a guy by the name of Gad, the prophet, to come speak to David. And this is odd. Verse 12, this is what Gad offers David from the Lord.
Go and tell David, thus says the Lord, I offer you three things. Choose from them for yourself that I may do it to you.
All right, so David, you guys remember those books? Like when I was a kid, they had them. I don't know that they had them when you guys grew up. But the Choose Your Own Ending books, where you would read a book and then it would say, if you want the story to end this way, go this way, turn to this page. David gets to choose your own ending. So he gets to choose his curse. Gad gives him three things and says, David, these are from the Lord. You choose. Keep going, Will.
So Gad came to David and told him and said to him, you shall 7 years of famine come to your land, or shall you flee 3 months before your enemies while they pursue you, or shall there be 3 days plagues in your land?
Okay. Now, anybody have a different number if you're reading in NIV in verse 13? 7 years of famine? Three. Okay. It's probably three. Chronicles says 3 years. So basically, it's 3, 3, and 3. Do you want 3 years of famine? Do you want 3 months of getting routed by your foes? Or do you want 3 days of plagues from God? What do you want? And David says, man, I will throw myself at the mercy of God. I'll take the 3 days of whatever God's going to bring. Okay. David said, let's fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great. Do not let me fall into the hand of men. I don't want to deal with men. I'll deal with God. And he says, okay. Verse 15, 70,000 people die as a result of David's census. Okay. Innocent. This is David's sin, and they're paying for it because of poor leadership. So in verse 13, 70,000 people die. God says it's enough. So he tells the angel of the Lord, who is at the administrating this, it is enough. Relax your hand. The angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. Okay, so keep that in the back of your head. They're in Jerusalem and they're on a threshing floor. Where were threshing floors in Israel? High or low? High. Okay, because you're threshing the wheat. So you would throw the wheat up in the air, the wind would blow away the chaff, and the solid, more valuable wheat would come down. So they're at this threshing floor by the name of Araunah the Jebusite. He owns this, okay? David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel of the Lord in verse 17. He says, I have sinned. What have, it is I who have done wrong, but these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and against my father's house. David sees these 70,000 die and says, Lord, they've done nothing wrong. I have sinned. This is on me. So again, the heart of David comes through. He owns this. He says, man, I knew better and I did it anyway. So in verse 18, this is what they do.
And Gad came that day to David and said to him, go up, erect an altar for the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite.
Araunah the Jebusite, or Ornan, is his name in 1 Chronicles 21. So I want you to go to the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite, okay? So and David, specifically, what are you going to do when you get there?
Build an altar.
You're going to build an altar, okay? Keep going.
So David, according to the word of Gad, went up as the Lord commanded. So Araunah looked and saw the king and his servants coming toward him. So Araunah went out and bowed before the king with his face to the ground. And Araunah said, Why has my lord the king come to his servant? And David said, To buy your threshing floor from you and build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be withdrawn from the people.
All right. So Araunah sees the king coming, which would have been an odd deal, and he says, dude, bows down and says, why are you here? And David says, I want to buy your land so that I can build an altar to God so this plague will be checked. Araunah says in verse 22, let my lord the king take and offer up what is good in his sight. Look, the oxen for burnt offering, the threshing sledges, and the yokes for the oxen and for the wood. Everything, O king, Araunah gives to the king. So what does Araunah say? You can have the land. And what else? Yeah. Here's a bag of Kingsford. Here's some lighter fluid. Here's matches. You can take it all. Here's some sheep to put on them. Everything is yours. David says now in verse 23, Aruna goes on, may the Lord your God accept you. However, the king says to Aruna in verse 24, no, and tell me if this is not one of the greatest verses you've ever heard on worship. I will surely buy it from you for a price. Thank you for the offer. I am not going to take it. I will buy it. For I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing. I will not give to God what I did not sacrifice for, what I did not earn. I'm not going to give him your stuff. If it didn't cost me anything, then it's not worth giving to God. That is a great, great statement regarding his heart. Okay, one sec. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. First Chronicle tells us there's an additional 600 shekels of silver that are paid for this land. Okay? Yeah.
That just reminds me of the prophecy against David when he took Uriah's wife. Because that's basically what she said to him. Like, there's this king that has all these sheep, and then goes to that man and takes that one sheep that he had.
Yeah.
And sacrifices it.
You wonder if he remembers that in his head of like, man, no, I'm not taking from you. So, and David, obviously, he's not hurting for money, right? He's the king of Israel. He has plenty. And he buys it. He does the right thing. Okay, so he buys this land. He buys this threshing floor of Aruna the Jebusite on a hilltop in Jerusalem. Okay, he built there an altar to the Lord, the burnt offerings, and offered peace offerings, burnt offerings. Thus, the Lord was moved by prayer for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. Okay, why is this story recorded for us? So David buys this random plot of land. God is bringing a plague in Israel. God says, here's how you're going to check it. You buy this guy's or take this guy's area and build an altar there. God says through Aruna, take it. I'll give it to you. David says, no, I will buy it from you and only buy it from you. Pays the guy 650 shekels of silver, buys it from him. He owns this now and then builds this altar. Why is the story here? Or maybe better yet, what is this piece of land that David just purchased? The Temple Mount. This is the Temple Mount. This is Mount Moriah, the same place we saw in Genesis 22 that Abraham took his son Isaac to go sacrifice him. Now, David is living around 1000 BC. Okay, so 3,000 years later, the most hotly contested piece of land in the world is what?
This place.
And who owns it?
David.
God. David purchased it. He has the receipt, right? He owns this piece of land. They bought it. And it's today one of the most interesting places in the world to visit. We got to go there when we were in Israel. The tension there, you can cut with a knife. It is palpable, and every time you go, you see it. And for those of you guys that have been, you remember that. It's a weird, weird place to be. With the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque on there that represent the Muslim faith, you've got the Jews that have their holy site that was desecrated up there. And that's coming years later after Solomon's going to build that. It's going to be torn down, rebuilt, torn down by the Romans. They want to be there. Then you've got Christians that think Jesus was crucified somewhere outside this place, so it's our land, and everyone thinks it's theirs, right? At the end of the day, it's God's. And David buys it. It's Israel's property. And we know one day there's going to be a third temple built here, according to the book of Ezekiel, that God will have a temple rebuilt again that is coming, that is in yet future in the millennial kingdom. Shay talked with you guys about a little bit on Tuesday. That is still yet future, but it's coming. And I think what's important about this is to remember David purchased this land. So the fallout today is pretty significant. And what to do with it, man, I don't know. It's a mess. But at the end of the day, this is how that story ends. And the plague was checked, okay?
Who are the Jebusites? Were they...
They were the people that were native to Jerusalem before anyone else got there, okay? So Jebus is the name of the city before they rename it the City of David in Jerusalem. So as you look at the topography of the city, the Jebusites lived on the top. David, as he comes in, takes kind of the lower portion of the city. So David lived down here, And Mount Moriah was this whole hill that kind of went up. Okay, so they lived up there. Hi, no, you're good. Come on in, we're almost done. So David bought that from the Jebusites who would have been there. So they had a good relationship, but they just lived in the land prior to that.
Ever seen that Simpsons episode? Homer doesn't know the real name of Jesus, and he says instead Jeebus.
Ah, okay. Yeah, Jebus, yeah, Jebusites. Nothing to do with that, but yeah, they were the guys that were, yeah.
Is that what gets, like, accidentally dragged on the mission trip?
I don't know.
All right.
This is the same place you said the Abraham.
Yeah. Now, Moriah is a big, I say big, it's a mountain. So there's not, it's a large hill. So we don't know, is it the exact same, like, this size room? No, probably not. But it's a large area that was purchased, and Abraham would have went to the top of the mountain, which is where you sacrifice things. It would have been, yeah, we're talking about the same, probably within a couple hundred yards, Masomenos, of where David just, you know, bought this property, okay? So, 1 Kings tomorrow, shall we? We'll get into Solomon and dividing of the kingdom and all that's coming next, all right? So, tie a bow on yet another book. So, you guys, enjoy the rest of your day.